the Mason-Dixon. This is the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. Here is your host, Brian McClanahan.
Welcome back to the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. This is your host, Brian McClanahan, and this is episode 143, covering the week of October 22nd through October 26th, 2018. Glad to have you back on the program. Very glad to be here. Don't forget to follow the Abbeville Institute on Twitter, at Abbeville Institute. Like our Facebook page, at Abbeville Institute. And, of course, subscribe to our YouTube page, at Abbeville Institute. You can find all of those social media buttons at the top of our webpage, abbevilleinstitute.org. While you're there, give us an email address, and we'll give you a free ebook. You'll get on our email list, and you'll get our daily dose of Dixie Monday through Friday, and our weekly email on Saturday or Sunday, which includes a link to this podcast. You can also get a link to this, or access to this podcast, I should say, through our mobile app. Just go to your favorite app store, Google Play, iTunes, and you can get the Abbeville Institute app. Get Abbeville Institute on the go. It's free of charge. So go on out there and get that. You also have access to our website through the app and all of our audio files, which we have over 200 lectures from all of our conferences available on the app as well. So it's a great resource, and you can have the Abbeville Institute in your vehicle, on your commute, on the train, whatever you're doing. You can have Abbeville Institute whenever you would like it. Also, don't forget that our Abbeville Institute apparel is available on the website. Just get the top of the page where it says support. You can click on that, and it has a link to shop where you can go out and get your embroidered material. It's very nice, high-quality material. The embroidering is done very well, so you can get your Abbeville Institute gear, and you can also help us continue to explore what is true and valuable in the Southern tradition by donating to the Abbeville Institute, also under that support tab. You have various options monthly and annually to donate to the Institute. So if you do like what we do, you like our podcast, you like the website, you like our conferences, you like all of those things, which all of that stuff is, again, free of charge, you would want to go on out and help support the Abbeville Institute. We appreciate every red cent that you can send our way. Okay, also, one of the last reminders, in fact, next week will be the very last reminder. If you want to attend the conference in Dallas, Texas, on secession and state nullification, an academic look at these two ideas, which are certainly part of the Southern tradition, you need to get in and register. Time is running out. We've only got a couple of weeks left, and we have to cut that off. It will be probably November 5th as the cutoff date. So you want to get in, and you want to register for the conference. It will be a fun time. You're going to be around a lot of like-minded people, and it's an interesting topic because, as we're going to talk about this in just a few minutes here, I'll discuss some things. It is in the news, and so you're going to want to get out there and attend this conference. All of our conferences are first class, and they're well worth your time. So if you're in the Dallas, Texas area, or you live west of the Mississippi, we've never done a conference in Texas before, you're going to want to get out and go to that conference. Okay, let's talk about the material for the week, because I think that there's some interesting essays, too, that have to do with the Southern tradition, and two that have to do with Lincoln, and then the essay on Monday deals with our conference. So let me start with that one first, and it was written by Ronnie Kennedy. The title of it is "Could Cal Exit Create a Left-Right Confederacy?" Now we've talked a lot about this on the podcast already, but as I said, this is in the news, and I'll tell you why it's in the news, because Hillary Clinton put it in the news, and we'll have a piece next week on that, at least that I scribbled up. Very briefly on that particular episode. But progressives are thinking about secession. They're thinking about nullification. They're thinking about the states as a hedge against the general government. And that, of course, is purely American. And the South held on to that particular tradition longer than any other section of the country. But this idea that somehow the states can protect its citizens from an oppressive central authority is nothing new. In fact, it goes all the way back to the colonial period when the colonies were doing that against the British leading up to the American War for Independence. If you look at the Suffolk Resolves, for example, out of Massachusetts, they were nullification acts. If you look at what the colony of Virginia could do, even in relation to Richmond itself. The local courts would resist what they considered to be unconstitutional edicts from the central authority in Virginia. So this tradition of the local resisting the central authority goes back to the American colonial period. And of course, it's part of also the British tradition going all the way back to the Magna Carta. So this is not something that's alien to America. But what is interesting is that progressives are now starting to promote this because they don't believe that they're ever going to control, or that they're not going to control, the reins of government, the mechanisms of power, for at least a short time, with the Supreme Court now, in their mind, being decidedly right-wing. And so you see, this is the way the progressives had been able to control the general government for the last 50 to, well, actually, since the FDR administration, the end of the FDR administration. So we're looking at 80 years. They've had an unstoppable control of the Supreme Court. And now that they don't control that anymore, they're worried that all of their pet projects are going to be destroyed because the court's going to come in and overturn all these things. And of course, the court was making some very bad decisions, not based on the Constitution at all, but on politics throughout much of its recent history. So they believe that they can block much of the evil, quote-unquote, evil right-wing legislation by putting their power back in the states. And this is interesting. You have the Cal Exit Group, which is going to speak at our conference. And the idea of that is to get people talking, to get people discussing on left and right. And that what we need to do is have a real conversation that's not based on physical threats, that's not based on violence, that's not based on a type of political imperialism. You see, the real problem in all of this has always been nationalism and political nationalism, because it creates a type of political imperialism. You're going to take my views on government, you're going to take my views on society, and you're going to like it, or we're going to punish you in some way. And if you look at the antebellum period, you certainly had this. I mean, in fact, New England sectional nationalism, I should say, what they called nationalism, was in fact New England sectionalism. It always was. The South really was trying to be nationalist, which was good for the entire Union, particularly in the early 19th century. If you look at Calhoun's support for the Tariff of 1816, for example, he was a nationalist in the purest sense. He understood that the tariff would not be as beneficial to the South as it was to the North, but this was a bone. He wanted to throw the North a bone because they had been hurt by the War of 1812, New England had, and so he's trying to do it in the spirit of real nationalism. If you look at even Henry Clay's support for the American system, and we can debate the merits of the American system, whether it was a good idea or not, but Clay, of course, was a Southerner, and Clay was a nationalist. And I think at his heart, at the heart of Clay's ideology, was a certain type of Southern nationalism, which he believed that the American system would be best for the entire Union. Now, again, we can debate whether that was the case, but that's a different type of nationalist. Henry Clay was not a New England sectionalist. Henry Clay, in many ways, he was a national Republican. He was a Jeffersonian. He was a national Republican. And the national Republicans were a little bit different from the New England sectionalists that arose in that particular part of the United States. They were certainly only interested in their well-being. They didn't really care what happened to the South. They were fine with punishing the South because, again, Clay was not ideologically disposed to be against the South. He was a Southerner himself. And so he shared their concerns at times with what New England was doing, but he certainly was interested in this national perspective. But that type of nationalism disappeared when you move forward in American history, and what we get is sectionalism. And so now we have a political type of nationalism that is different. It's not based on section. It's based on a political ideology, whether it's Marxism, whether it's cultural Marxism, whatever the case may be. And the left has been taken over by this type of political ideology. And they're trying to foist it on the rest of the United States. And if you resist that, of course, for years they would just use the Supreme Court. Now that they can't do that, they're looking for the states to be the fetus, so to speak, of these type of ideologies. And not just that, to ensure that those ideologies continue to exist. It's funny that they think this, because, of course, the progressives for years, as I spoke about in my own podcast, The Brian McClanahan Show, the progressives for years did this exact thing. They were using the states as a vehicle to start promoting their agenda. And then, of course, then it became national. And so they're rediscovering the states as a vehicle to help promote progressivism. You can look at all kinds of things that were born in the progressive movement that have been implemented at state level. And in many ways, the states have always been the innovators. There's no question that the states, more than the general government, have been innovators when it comes to things, political ideas. You know, for example, universal suffrage, women's suffrage. When you look at direct democracy techniques like initiative, referendum, recall, these type of things always were created at the states. Even national health care, Romney care, was there before Obamacare, and the Democrats correctly pointed this out. So it's interesting that the progressives are going in this direction, because they're rediscovering the Southern tradition. Hillary Clinton has gone neo-Confederate, so she's proving that we were right all along, right? The states were always the way to help protect the citizens against the general government. Now, I don't believe that they're committed to this position. If they can get back the reins of power, they're going to just discard it as fast as they adopted it. But maybe some of their sycophants, maybe some of the people that are the intellectually curious people will continue this position. I think the CalExit people are in that vein. They're starting to say, hey, there's something to this. We don't even need the central government. We can just use California. Who cares about the central government? It's much easier, even as Hillary Clinton herself admitted, it's much easier to get action at the state level than it is at the general government. So I highly recommend reading this little piece by Ronnie Kennedy, and because he talks about some of these things. And this coalition, this, you want to have a real conversation? Live and let live. I mean, that's it. If the left and the right want to have a real conversation, and I think the right is more willing to do this than the left, they always have been. Leave us alone, we'll leave you alone. But if the left could somehow come to a moment, a come to Jesus moment, which of course they don't believe in Jesus, so many of them, so it's hard to do that. But a come to Jesus moment where they can say, you know what we need to do? We need to live and let live. We'll let these people, these right wingers, have control of their states. We'll have control of our states, and we'll all just get along then. We need to discard all this nationalism, all these things that are national issues. And that, of course, is purely part of the Southern tradition. The South held on to that longer. Federalism is what we're talking about here, and this is the basis of America. So it's interesting that all these things are being brought up, that people are starting to discuss these issues and the merits of these issues. And, of course, that's a main topic of our conference. Where did this stuff come from? Where do these ideas come from? Are people really actively looking at these things today? And we're seeking to understand this as part of the American tradition. And certainly I think the South plays a role in that. So that's a great piece. And then let's talk about the two pieces on Lincoln. The first was a book review on Tuesday, Lincoln as He Really Was. The book is by Charles Pace and is published by Shotwell Publishing. The foreword was written by Thomas DiLorenzo, whose Real Lincoln really changed the way a lot of people thought about Abraham Lincoln. And just within the last few years, the neoconservatives have attacked it. I mean, they attack it constantly. They call DiLorenzo a man on the fringe. He's got all these people that now believe him, and they're just a bunch of crazy libertarians and all these. And you got the Southern conservatives who just want to bash Lincoln, and all this stuff is wrong. Lincoln really is a great man. Well, Pace takes all that apart, and the review is by Michael Potts. And look. Lincoln, and that's interesting because you have people like Richard Weaver, who was one of the intellectual deans of the South, particularly in the 20th century, who didn't dislike Lincoln. And there is something to be said about Lincoln in this particular way. I think if Lincoln had survived, he was much more pragmatic than any of the radical Republicans. Would he have been able to control Reconstruction is an interesting question. I think if Lincoln was in control of Reconstruction, Reconstruction would have gone differently in the South. Perhaps the entire process of Reconstruction and reconciliation would have gone differently because Lincoln himself was a reconciliationist. So in that way, Lincoln was different from the radicals within his own party. And there's actually a position, a book on this, and the argument is fairly interesting. The title of the book is What Shall We Do with the Negro? And it's written by Paul Escott, Lincoln, White Racism and Civil War America. And Escott contends that had Lincoln survived, he was trying to create a new party. He was trying to get away from the radicals, create a new party of conservative Republicans and, of course, Democrats, and they would control Reconstruction. So he was trying to orchestrate some type of new political organization, and then he's assassinated. And that political organization would have been different when it comes to Reconstruction. But Lincoln before that, I mean, the problem with Lincoln, and as I've written about in my 9 Presidents Who Screwed Up America, and it was funny when I was doing the publicity for that, everyone focused on Lincoln. I mean, this is right where they went. They wanted me to talk about Lincoln. How can you say Abraham Lincoln screwed up America? Well, the problem with Lincoln is that he completely disregarded the Constitution before that point. And of course, even by marching troops into the South, he was doing that. Now, I know that there are those that say, well, I mean, there's precedent for this. There's George Washington, there's Andrew Jackson. Of course, I think they're problematic as well, which is why I criticize both those presidents. And you can say, well, the president has to enforce the laws. Well, okay, but the Congress actually has to call it the militia. And if you're saying that there's a state of insurrection in those states, or if there's domestic violence in those states, then the states themselves have to ask for the militia to be marched into those states, and none of the southern states did. And of course, Lincoln is creating a very unique perspective on the Constitution and is secession legal or not. These are interesting legal questions that never have been conclusively answered. Even people that say that Texas v. White did it, it didn't. Still, there are many problems with Lincoln constitutionally, and that's the avenue I took in my book. And I think Pace does the same thing. He also is very critical of Lincoln's upbringing and who he was as a man and all of that. You know, Albert Taylor Bledsoe did a nice job with that in his Davis a Traitor. He looked at Lincoln in a very critical way. In fact, knew Lincoln well, knew him intimately because he was served as a lawyer with Lincoln in Illinois. And so Lincoln, the myth, is much different than Lincoln, the real Lincoln, which is why, you know, DiLorenzo titled his book that way. And I think Pace has done a wonderful job in also promoting this position on Lincoln as someone who is much more human and much more flawed than the Lincoln myth. The Lincoln myth is what pervades America, and unfortunately pervades America because it's not real. The Lincoln myth is not real. And so I think that it's important to understand that as we look at Abraham Lincoln in American society. And so I would highly recommend you pick up this book. It's not a long book. It's about 200 pages. And of course, Shotwell Press Publishing does a great job putting out books like this. There's a real vacuum in the modern publishing industry for books of this type. And so I would highly recommend getting it. It's not expensive. I think it's, you know, $20. Well worth your time. And of course, all the other Shotwell Publishing books too. Go ahead and pick those up as well. But this book is very good. And it gets into this position on Lincoln as not the great emancipator, not the great hero, but a very flawed man, a man who essentially destroyed the Constitution. And not just that, the myth of Lincoln as a country bumpkin and all these other things is just completely false. So again, great look at Lincoln. And then we have John Taylor's piece, An Act of Tyranny, which gets into the Clement Vallandigham situation in Ohio. Now, this is a chapter from his book, Union at All Costs. So again, another book that you should pick up. But this idea of Lincoln suspending the First Amendment and the attack on the First Amendment during the war. This was a very serious thing. It's something that even Lincoln acolytes, even Lincoln lovers, have to admit that Lincoln's position and the Republican Party's position on the First Amendment, the freedom of the press, the freedom of speech, was problematic at best. Even, you know, there's a book entitled Lincoln and the Power of the Press by Harold Holzer. Harold Holzer is one of the foremost Lincoln lovers in the academic community. But even he admits in this book, Lincoln and the Power of the Press, that Lincoln and the Lincoln administration were abusing the First Amendment. You can't get around it. You can't gloss this over, the abuse of the First Amendment. And of course, the Vallandigham episode, where Vallandigham was eventually booted out of the country simply for opposing the Lincoln administration, is one of the great acts of tyranny in American history. You had other cases of this, not to that extent, but of course you had newspapers shut down. You had individuals arrested for simply opposing the Lincoln administration. This is where Lincoln was trampling all over the Constitution. And then you had the Congress doing some of the same things. I wrote my dissertation on James Byard of Delaware, and Byard was a Lincoln opponent. He was constantly afraid that he was going to be arrested. He was threatened with tar and feathers at times in Philadelphia and other places. So this was a real problem in the North, and the actions against people being able to speak their mind freely who were opposed to the war. Imagine today if you went out and you were opposed to the Trump administration, which, of course, a lot of Americans are, and you're being arrested for it. Or if you had been opposed to the Obama administration, which a lot of Americans were, and you were being arrested for it. But that's what was happening in the 1860s. Now you can say, well, yeah, but there's a war going on. There's no war going on now. It doesn't matter. You have to be extra cautious about civil liberties in time of war, because that's when the greatest threat is there for the suppression of those civil liberties. And if you stamp out any type of opposition, you're living in essentially a tyranny, which is what many Northerners believed was going on in the North. I mean, this is well documented. They were saying these things. We're being arrested. Where newspapers are shut down. There's violence against us. You have Vallandigham being sent out of the country. That's tyranny. That's not constitutional. That's tyranny. That's not the land of the free. In fact, you can make a really interesting case. You know, who protected civil liberties better in the United States or the Confederate States? Which one did a better job of it? And I think clearly, at least in the early phases of the war, the Confederacy did. Now, they had their own issues, but their suspension of habeas corpus, for example, was done legally, if you go back and look at how that happened, rather than the way the Lincoln administration did it. So there's a lot going on there, and I think that understanding this particular phase of the Lincoln administration goes a long way to getting to the heart of why people called Lincoln a tyrant, even at the when he was president. I mean, look, Lincoln barely won in 1864. If the South was still in the Union, he doesn't win the election. If there's not a four-way split in 1860, Lincoln never becomes president. He's a minority president. He never should have been president. But because the Democrats split, because you had John Bell, and then because the South is out of the Union, Lincoln wins again in 1864. So Lincoln is an anomaly in many ways. In American history, but one who, of course, everyone points to and says, greatest president in American history. What for? I guess if you want to talk about abuse of power, sure. But how could he be the greatest president in American history when there are so many problems with how he understood his oath of office, which is where I got into on the nine presidents who screwed up America. All right, so we have those two pieces on Lincoln, and then we have two on the Southern tradition, Southern history. The first is, was the Old South feudal? And I was sent a piece from a blogger who was very critical of this piece. It's written by Michael Martin. And trying to make fun of it, and it just fell flat. First of all, the satire was just ridiculously It was poorly written. But not just that. The fact is that the South was not feudal. I mean, Michael Martin leaves the question open. There are certainly parts of Southern culture that were traditionally traditionally Western and Western civilization. And he goes into some of these things, you know, honor, chivalry, manliness, these type of things. There were certainly a remnant of traditional English Western civilization that went back to the Middle Ages. And without question, that was an important part of Southern culture. But feudalism itself has to have a certain type of government and society for it to exist. And I know that Southerners, even in the antebellum period, there were some that started pushing this Ivanhoe vision of the South, you know, Sir Walter Scott, Ivanhoe, and the idea that, you know, the South was somehow this living in this medieval type of society. But when you look at feudalism and you look at how it operated in Europe, particularly when it came to the economy and the government, when feudalism was dominant in Europe, you really didn't have many small landowners at all, independent landowners. You had the large estates, and then you had the serfs. There wasn't much else. And the feudal lords did not view themselves as anything but a lord over an estate. They didn't work. They didn't manage the estate. That was all done for them. So there was their primary occupation was warfare. I mean, these were men that were going out and marching out to go lay siege to other castles and other estates and be part of that forays and raids. So their entire lifestyle was different. In the South, as it's been conclusively shown by Frank Owlsley and many, many others, you had the backbone of the South was more Roman. I mean, this is Bradford's position as well. The backbone of the South was more Roman than feudal. You had the existence of a dominant small yeoman landownership. This is, if you look at Rome, the independent landowner was the backbone of Republican Rome. The South was not feudal, it was Republican. Certainly it had the plantations, but even these plantation owners themselves viewed themselves as Republican most of the time, and progressive, actually. If you look at Eugene Genovese's The Slaveholder's Dilemma, this is part of it. Southerners actually viewed the pro-slavery ideologues, viewed slavery as a progressive labor system. It wasn't feudal. They weren't looking back. They were looking forward. So that republicanism saturated the South. I mean, I think you can say that the South, more than anything else, held on to republicanism longer than the North did. Even the act of secession, that was very much a republican position. Republican with a lowercase r. So these plantations certainly did exercise. It was the rule of the manor, and they could ignore laws. I mean, you know, Nathaniel Macon, for example, considered his plantation to be his country. And you had that. I mean, you're talking about massive estates at times, and there was no other law that could ever, realistically, or at least I should say theoretically, that could do much. Realistically, they could. I mean, if you look at certain episodes, the state did intervene, and of course, in a feudal situation, you're not going to have that. In a feudal situation, there is no law that can trump the law of the manor. But you could in the South. And you know, the plantation owner did set the agenda for his own estate. The state could still move in at times and trump that. So the South wasn't feudal at all. And Michael Martin wasn't trying to spit on the traditions of the South in any way. He was simply asking a question. A question I think is important to ask because when you get to the heart of it, the South was more American than anything. And by saying the South is not feudal, you're actually saying the South is very American and that Southerners, even in 1860 and 61, were a continuation of the American tradition. Everyone recognized that in the immediate period after the war. The blood of the of Americans. You know, these were real Americans, and Northerners said this. And when going to Confederate monument unveilings and other things, these are Americans, just like us. They're all Americans, and they need to be respected as Americans. We had differences of opinion, but we were all Americans. And so that republicanism is the important thing. The question is, was the South feudal, but how Republican was the South? And I think it was more Republican than people understand. So it's a great piece. It brings up a very good question about this. And so you get that, the South was just this, you know, this backwards economy. No, not in their own mind. They weren't. And they were very Republican. And the backbone of the South was the independent landowner, the small farmer. More than anything else, that was the backbone of the South. Certainly it had vestiges of old Western civilization. They held onto that longer, again, than any other section. And that's something to be discussed and chewed and investigated. And as we do in the Abbeville Institute, we explore what is true and valuable in the Southern tradition, and if there's valuable parts of that to held on to. But the South was Republican, and in their mind, far more progressive than anything. And finally, we have a piece by Forrest Merriam, "The Desert Blooming Like the Rose." This is an interesting piece on Southern religion, and I think if you look at the Southern tradition, I'm just going to briefly get into this because we're running up against time here. But when you look at the Southern tradition, and you look at what made the Southern tradition unique, and again, one thing the South held on to longer than any other section was Christianity. Still to this day, the South is called the Bible Belt. And if you look at these surveys and that are done, and people are polled about their religious beliefs, the South is the most religious part of the country. The South, and then into places like Oklahoma, which is still very much part of the South, but in many, many ways. But that's part of the South. That's part of the Southern tradition. This strong belief in Christianity, and if you go back to the colonial period, you had a different type of Christianity than you have today. I mean, Orthodox Christianity was much more important in the colonial South, particularly in the Tidewater region along the coast, than you had anywhere else. But as the second Great Awakening in particular moves to the South, you get the evangelical spirit moving in, and you get the Puritan churches, the Baptist Church, the Methodist Church, which you could debate if it's more Anglican influenced or Puritan influenced, but regardless, you get these more evangelical churches moving into the frontier, the Presbyterians, and so that takes hold, it takes root. And that particular part of the Southern tradition is important for understanding what the South was. And even this idea of chivalry, which I just talked about a minute ago, a lot of that is, it's not medieval chivalry. It's more Christian chivalry than anything else. There is a difference between medieval chivalry and Christian chivalry. Some of the tenets are the same, but the reason that they had chivalry in the Middle Ages was because of battles and tournaments. There was a certain type of respect you had to show your opponent in those arenas. But Christian chivalry is something different in that it's more of a social organization. And so you have to understand how important chivalry was to Christians, a Christian chivalry. And so the South hanging on to that, again, longer, the South being the bastion of manners in the United States. I just saw the other day, yesterday, and you're going to get this podcast on Saturday, so it was on Thursday, there was a Senate candidate in North Carolina, a lefty, but he actually posted on social media, with all the divisiveness in America, I'd like to say my opponent, who's this young lady actually from Florida who's running in North Carolina, is a good, upstanding person. She's run a positive campaign. She's a nice person. Everyone should at least consider her and give her candidacy and give her campaign a look because she's done a very good job. This is a North Carolinian and a Floridian really having a positive back and forth and not being angry with each other. And I think that's very Southern of them. We can look at Southern politics as divisive because it always has been. I mean, there's, Southerners have gotten at each other's throats and Southerners have attacked each other. I mean, stuff happens all the time, even going back to the antebellum period. But this type of manners that you find, you don't find it as much in the North. Again, we, as Hank Williams Jr. says, we say grace and we say ma'am. If you ain't into that, we don't give a damn, right? So that's the South that people recognize and understood. And Christianity is at the heart of that. So this older religiousness in the South, you should really consider that as part of the Southern tradition. I think Forrest Marion writes wonderful pieces on that. He also wrote, from what I understand, a very good book on the war in Afghanistan. And so you should go out and take a look at that too. I haven't read it, but a very good book on the war in Afghanistan. So just look him up, Forrest Marion. His book's on Amazon, but this piece on religiousness in the South is also well worth your time and reading. And a prominent evangelical figure in North Carolina. All right, so that's it for the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. Hope you enjoyed it. Until next time, good day.